Okay. Welcome. All right. Welcome back to Millennial 2018. And now, since my connection with, I've sorted it out. Let me know if there are any problems. The connection with the previous stream was dreadful. I think it was my VPN.
I'm back to Millennial 2018.
And now it's fine. But since my connection was so dreadful then, I probably should reread the schedule for this evening. Yes, please do admire my the purple t-shirt and so on. So, okay, the schedule is, now we've got Babylonian Hebrew, then Erkenbrand, then Saber's Edge, then Morgoth, then Lucy Brown. That's what's going to happen tonight. And this is the last night of live broadcast tomorrow. There'll be four, but they're all five. But they'll be pre-recorded, so not quite the same. So here we go. This is like the last live night of Millennial 2018. I hope you enjoy it. And please let me know if it starts to go dreadful in the bandwidth thing. So with that all said, God, I look like my hair's a bit too extreme. Sorry about that, everyone. But I'll just move on.
Well, that's a perfect beginning to our conversation, actually, yeah. Because I was just talking before this.
Yes, welcome, Babylonian Hebrew. Talk about our hair. Go on.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mr. Woz. But yeah, on the subject of, it's always good to be here. Like, when's the last time I was here? Like, four years ago or something like that?
I think it would be 2015, maybe 2016, but I don't think so.
Man, it was a while back. I still have clips of that. And actually, right now my channel doesn't have any videos showing on it. But right after this, because I'm probably going to be getting some new people in, I'm going to be posting those clips, making them unlisted again so people can see them on my channel. Anyway, hair. We were saying some interesting stuff. Like, you were saying, oh, my hair's grown out. Like, but, you know, it doesn't matter because, you know, I'm sort of doing my thing now. I don't have to, like, you know, look a certain kind of clean-cut, societally enforced way. And I think there's actually a certain power in growing one's hair out. It's sort of, I'm not sure if this is true for European people, but I feel like, at least for, in the context of a sort of Eurocentric society, if you're like someone of West African descent, or if you're a Jew, growing out the Jewfro, kind of like I'm doing right now, you know, growing out the Afro is a symbol of, it's a symbol of sort of getting in touch with something something far larger than yourself, and you could say also, oh,
it depends on the size of the Jewfro, doesn't it?
Yeah, it might be something far larger, but I think that it can be a symbol of resistance, it can be a symbol of solidarity, but I think that Europeans too, like if you look at Europeans, many of the ancient depictions and the old depictions of Europeans, many of them had, you know, long hair and intricately braided and ornate hairstyles, men and women. And there's a lot of interesting stuff. There's kind of a power and an increase in identity awareness when you grow out your hair because you're fully actuating your features in like the manner of your people.
That's definitely, there's something to that. I mean, as for me, I don't know. It's as I said to you before, it's like I realized, well, I've got no job to lose or whatever, no position to protect. So I may as well just grow my hair and see how it, you know, see how it goes and see how it feels. So I don't think it's ever been this long. It was fairly long at the start of art college, but maybe this is even longer now. And so I'll just demonstrate the sheer length of my hair. Hold on. As you can see, it's pretty extreme. There you go. So there. All right. Hope everyone's happy with that. So there we are. That's what we were just discussing while we were testing Ed's internet connection. So with that out of the way, Ed, what is it that you want to talk about? Do you want to introduce yourself to the audience first? I think that might be a good idea, because obviously people will be a bit surprised to see a Jew on my channel. So explain the background to that.
All right, yeah, actually, this is a fascinating story. I'll go into the backstory right here. Okay, so I have been involved with, I guess, sort of NRX and NRX-associated circles and blogosphere content and whatnot, dating back all the way to like Royce / Chateau Hartiste's really early stuff. I found that when I was like super young, probably shouldn't have stumbled upon it. And then I found, Radish Mag, Mold Bug, Nick Land, of course, Xenosystems. And then of course, I mean, Mark Citadel, Adam Wallace, and Millennial Woz, and, you know, Reactionary Expat. And I like, you know, Radish Mag.
As you called him, Seductionary Sex Pot.
Yeah, Seductionary Sex Pot, exactly. I remember that. Yeah, his videos are up and mirrored, thankfully, which is a great thing to see. But yeah, So that's when I first crossed paths with you. And I was still kind of ideologically trying different things out at that point in time. But over the course of that period, I'd say that I increasingly gravitated towards kind of a Garveyite style, but not quite Garveyite, but a Gordonite or like A.D. Gordonite Garveyite kind of secular repatriationist ideology. The conclusion that I had basically come to is listening to enough people talk about, you know, the way that society, well, and it was also things I was reading. Like I was reading a lot of Spengler, and I was reading like a lot of sort of anthropological and sociological stuff about like tribe and identity and like how those things and like how in-group and out-group like manifest themselves societally. And
I think it's important. Yeah. There is an important thing to say here, which is that you're not the standard sort of stereotypical Jew in that you're not Ashkenazi.
I'm part Ashkenazi. I'm part Ashkenazi and I'm part Mizrahi. Mizrahim from Baghdad and Ashkenazim from Germany, Bavaria area. Predominantly right. Mizrahi.
Right. Okay. I didn't realize that you were part Ashkenazi. I don't know if I knew that 3 years ago or not. But I seem to recall that you did feel a certain separation from, you know, the normal diaspora Jews, the sort of stereotypical ones in New York.
Well, that brings me to the crux of the problem is the conclusion that I basically come to is that diaspora itself is the problem. Because, you know, if you think like there is, I guess, in a lot of right-wing circles specifically on the internet, and it's very easy to perceive things this way on the outside. And I mean, you know, don't trust me. I'm probably just some subversive Jew, but this is just my take telling you how it feels from the inside is the way that the perception is basically that, you know, Jews are like good things for us, but not for you. You know, we get our wall, our traditional kind of like in-group preferential society, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, while that may kind of superficially manifest itself as being the case, well, even inside of the diaspora, you'll notice that there's increased tribalism. At the same time, the state of being in diaspora itself is what I came to realize is it is a pitiable state. It can reduce a nation to a shambling ghost people. Effectively, the moment that the diaspora was fully crystallized and we lost access to our indigenous land when we were, and you know, increasingly as that became more and more crystallized and solidified, we became more, less and less of a proper nation, a nation that has all different, you know, castes and roles, you know, the warrior role, the priestly role, the merchant role, the farmer role, the peasant role, the artisan role, the knight. But
well, it's the difference between having a house and having a camper van.
Exactly.
You need fewer people to run that, and you're optimized for a mobile nomadic existence.
Exactly. And our society has been reduced almost exclusively to a mix of, at least today, I'd say predominantly mercantile and sort of priestly or brahminical or scribe-ish type castes. So I guess, and that, I don't think that's a healthy, just growing up in that and seeing that, I was like, this is not a healthy mode of civilization. So effectively my end goal is, or what I hope to see is a full negation and truncation of the diaspora. I personally, myself, I'm working on my Aliyah plans right now. They're partway in motion. And I would recommend, but not just to any Jews watching, if you're, let's say, an exogenous minority group and you're living in the West right now, and there's anything about the West that, you know, dissatisfies you or makes you feel uncomfortable, that's actually perfectly normal. If you live the West, you know, the West, America and the West, these are Eurocentric societies. These are societies that were created by European people. So if you don't, let's say, fit in perfectly with the beauty standards of that society, you know, your hair is too curly or your nose isn't upturned enough or something like that. It's little, you know, little things like that. I mean, it's obviously more of a difference for like someone who is like, let's say West African descent or something like, or East Asian descent. But if you feel like, you know, that feeling of, you know, being marginalized, being an outsider, et cetera, something like that, even in small ways, you know, many Jews don't experience that. And many Jews do seamlessly slip in and assimilate, but many don't. And those who don't, you know, just the nature of being this exogenous group with this kind of colonial history of back and forth conflict via soft and hard power, this interchange, this cycle that the Jews in the West have been locked in. It's like with all of that baggage accumulated, many Jews living in the West today are uncomfortable in the West, and they they bray about this. They make this an issue. And because fundamentally, if you're like a diasporic population living in the West, you have two options: A, to make yourself more in the image of the society, or B, to make the society more either in your image, in the image of what you prefer, or simply in a generic man's image. And this is why, you know, humanistic ideologies are appealing to, you know, people who are, let's say, you know, from a minority background or otherwise from some sort of like marginalized context.
Yeah, they want to sort of
generic
culture. Yeah.
And it makes sense, but the point is, I think that fundamentally, this is why a moral repatriationism is what would allow my people to blossom and flourish. And before anyone says it in the chat, and I'm completely against aid from the West to Israel or any Middle Eastern or non-Western countries in general. I think that every civilization should be allowed to develop and discover itself at its own pace. And yeah, there is room for interchange and there is room for trade, but I think that, wouldn't it be a beautiful world if each civilization could flourish on their own terms? Sorry for the rant.
No, it was a good rant that went around a wee bit, but it was all quite added up to a coherent whole. So don't worry about it. I mean, yeah.
Pardon the incoherency. I just had a big surgery, plus I'm super sleep deprived, but yeah, I'm trying to do my best here.
You're doing fine. I mean, I think the key point here is that if you are an outsider, what most outsiders have to do is they just have to like or lump it. But what has happened increasingly in the West, certainly over the last 100 years, less than that, is that minorities have been granted the right to change the West in order that it suits them better. And of course, the native peoples of the West were never consulted on this. It was just foisted upon them. It was just decreed. And one of the groups who have been at the forefront of that is diaspora, largely Ashkenazi Jews. Now, what would you say about that?
Oh, no doubt at all, simply because we are one of the oldest minority groups in the West, and we have this immense history of built-up resentment that can be played from both angles. Like a Westerner can say, oh, you know, look at these parasites. They've been embedded in our civilization, you know, subverting us for thousands of years, you know, exploiting us through usury, you know, causing all these economic instabilities, causing all these cultural instabilities, you know, et cetera, you know, foisting their values upon us. And similarly, Jews can say, oh, well, you know, look at the history of Jews in the West. You know, you colonized us in our indigenous land. You displaced us. You relegated us to second-class citizenship for many years, and the pogroms and World War II, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, both sides have a case to make, and fundamentally, the grievances are just too raw here. And because of this built-up history in diaspora, plus the inherent nature of the kind of
nomadic,
the kind of diasporic nature that's been built up, in addition to the simple fact of the exogenous indigenous kind of like majority minority that kind of dichotomy combined with the built-up history, it just leads to so much resentment. And ultimately, it's just impossible to parse through, because really what you're dealing with is raw emotion. And I mean, it's like, for some of these people, it's like, okay, well, you can have your raw emotion, you can have this, but why also live in the West? Because you could be devoting your energy to making things better for your people, but instead you're devoting your energy to detracting from the West, effectively. And I know why Jews want to live in diaspora. Jews want to live in diaspora because it's more comfortable. Obviously, like, would you rather live in, like, if you look at the economic situation, would you rather live in Israel or America? You know, it's really all about money and comfort at the end of the day, is why diaspora is preferential to any people. But I believe that the spiritual reward, as it were, of, you know, let's say a country like, you know, like if a person of African descent repatriates to Ghana or Liberia, or if a person of Hebrew descent repatriates to Israel, the Levant, or any other instance where something like that happens, I think that those people will be their ancestors will be happy, but their descendants will bless the fact that they returned and that they didn't let their culture and heritage just sort of slip through their fingers in this rather hostile, parasitic way at that that I find fundamentally dishonorable in terms of with the way civilizational conflicts play out.
Yeah, dishonorable perhaps, but also weakening, infantilizing, because if you're not tied to the land, then you don't have that responsibility for the land, which, you know, makes men of you. It means you have that responsibility. But if you don't have that responsibility, then it's like you're a perpetual shopper or a perpetual tourist, just critiquing other people's attempts to create something out of the land, out of the earth. It's like being a spoiled child, really.
Yeah, and I mean, increasingly, I mean, a lot of people like to say consumerism, but really, the sort of consumerist capital, one world supermarket vision, where, you know, everyone's shopping at the one global supermarket on credit, is becoming increasingly a reality. And I don't know how sustainable it is, but it looks like we're going to be locked in this sort of post-capitalist hell world for a few more decades, if not 100 plus years.
Mm. So I suppose you've definitely made an argument here. Are there any other points that you'd want to add to it before we... Because I mean, this has only been going for about 20, 15 minutes. I don't know how long we've been going. Very short. I feel it's too short.
Diasporic people create... Diaspora is bad for nine out of 10 times. Diaspora is bad both for the people to which diaspora has happened, as well as the society which these diasporic people are embedded in as this sort of exogenous minority group. It's literally all around bad. It's really, really bad. And people just, you know, they can't see past their noses, as it were.
Well, that's terrible. Yeah. Let's change the subject. I mean, what I was going to say to make that's a dreadful thing you said, by the way, Ed. It's just terrible. But what I was going to say was, you see this with other minorities as well. There's this constant feeling of discomfort and paranoia about what white people think of them. And what are white people going to do? And then the minority thinks, well, what do we need to do to defend ourselves against that? And how, you know, how thorough can... And the thing they need to do to defend themselves is they need to deconstruct the white people to make them weaker. And so this is what you see all the time, not just Jews, but you know, other minorities as well are constantly getting in on that bandwagon. You know, even like concepts like whiteness, white privilege, that thing that I've... A few months ago, white informed civility.
Yeah, we were the OGs. So we were the OGs. There are some newcomers. They're a newcomer. I mean, it's just a slot that any group that falls into the same situation as Jews will inevitably come to fill. And this is bad because more and more people are becoming diasporic. You know, that's the pattern of the world. Even like, oh man, I mean, there are people who are even, I see in YouTube comment section, they're like, you know, European people in America are effectively going to become a diaspora. And it's like, you know, don't become a diaspora. You know, yes, you will survive as a civilization, but it's like, would you rather like survive like as a husk of a civilization, like, you know, drenched in like embalming fluid or whatever, like barely kept alive by some like iron lung or something like that? It's like, or would you rather be a you know, flourishing civilization? I would even, rather have a smaller territory than have a large empire or a large diasporic situation, because that's it's about being rooted fundamentally at the end of the day, and people don't realize how important that is until it's gone.
Oh, absolutely. I think this
also
is...
I just, sorry, no, go ahead, go, sir, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, you go. I was just going to agree and sort of echo your point, no pun intended, obviously.
No, I was just going to respond to something you said earlier. Yeah, the way that a lot of Jews think, specifically because of the events that happened, and I mean, I'm sure that there's a similar situation with Black people and, you know, like the transatlantic slave trade and Jim Crow being the reference points. But for Jews, a lot of Jews specifically, the reason why it's Ashkenazi Jews is because they went through the history with the Europeans. So what they'll basically think is, you know, okay, well, any semblance of European identity, what does European identity or Christianity or like Christianity manifesting itself lead to? Well, it leads to the pogroms and Kristallnacht and the Holocaust and so on and so forth. And that is basically, what do you call it? That's basically it's that kind of jump in logic where any amount of any amount of anything that resembles anything like kind of traditional European Christian, et cetera, Western, you know, it, that isn't, you know, Judeo-Christian triggers that like, uh-oh, you know, this might, it triggers that little thing in the brain. And I mean, that's with the history. I mean, I guess that's just why. And it also has to do, there's this culture where this stuff is kind of perpetually internally reinforced as well. I don't know where the socialization begins and the, I mean, it's mostly just socialization. It's just like kind of socialized into a lot of people from a very young age. And I mean, like there's the historical thing. And then there's some people who are like, you know, oh, it's like trauma. Like the trauma has like epigenetically affected us for generations. I mean, I don't know, but I think that's true.
And I think you see that in actually, even in white Americans, I think that they seem to miss Europe, a lot of them. Yeah. Which is not to say that I think they all miss Europe and they should come back, but I think that there is definitely a certain trauma that's still there.
That's, yeah, I agree. And you can see this in the way that, you know, these sort of, white Americans of mixed European ancestries, they love European coronation ceremonies simply on aesthetic grounds. They're just drawn to it. You know, that's the thing is people are drawn in this kind of very romantic, just like pure kind of aesthetic, visceral way. They're drawn to images that speak to them, but I mean, what does speak to them mean? It means speak to
them. Reassure them.
It means things that are comforting to them, things that they see echoes of themselves in. And this is why I think that a world where everyone is able to actuate on a civilizational group levels, all the way down to the smallest town, all the way down to the smallest neighborhood, I want to see people actuate in this manner. And the problem is the biggest thing stifling this actuation are, well, you'd have like, you know, raw kind of economic forces, like the kind of post-capitalist kind of like late capitalist direction of increased globalization that is, you know, anti-beauty and destroys anything aesthetically pleasing or anything traditional. But you also have this kind of like, yeah, this diasporic mindset, this kind of generic humanist diasporic mindset as well as, is opposed to, it wants to make the world flat, as it were. It wants to create a world of individual humans. You know, everyone's an individual, and that's fine. But it's like, ultimately, people need a foundation to base that upon. And many people aren't even provided that in context of, let's say, places like urban America. So they begin to, you know, seek it out, and they do it through like vague imagery and symbolism. And 9 out of 10 times, they don't even realize what they're doing as they're doing it. I'm talking about like, all the, you know, all the like white girls in America who love to watch the coronation ceremonies of European royals and things,
or
like
even
that.
Harry Potter.
Yes, precisely. Or Tolkien.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. That's a huge thing. Which, of course, that's another bloody thing. I mean, I haven't watched the original trilogy and I haven't watched the Hobbit trilogy either. But it's a big deal that they diversified the cast with the Hobbit trilogy. And, you know, put, you know, non-whites in there, because that's a head fuck for the whites who are watching this specifically to, or unconsciously, but specifically to get that sort of racial reassurance. Well, the presence of non-whites, I'm afraid, just does fuck that up. I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, the ghetto, whether, let's say it's a Muslim ghetto somewhere in Europe, if the fact that it's just Muslims there is what makes it reassuring for them. If there were suddenly white people there, it'd be like a head fuck, you know, what's going on here? There is no doubt about this. I mean, individuals don't interact with the world at the level of, like a supermarket shelf where there are all these different options and every one of them is equally meaningless. That is a sort of way of looking at, a way of being that we're being encouraged into, but I don't think it's healthy. Because I think that people do want, home, and that is geographic as well as cultural and ethnic.
Exactly, and people make neighborhoods in their own image. It's funny, like I was on the West Coast, and I was seeing, you know, it was very different the way that you know, say someone from China, like a family of Hakka Han ancestry from mainland China, the way that they will curate their garden. The way that they'll arrange their house, the way that they'll arrange their front lawn, the way they'll take care of their plants, what they'll prioritize is very different from the way that someone of European descent living in let's say, you know, Cupertino or Sunnyvale would. So these things manifest themselves. I mean, people make things that are comfortable to them and that they know. I mean, where does the biology stop? Where does the socialization begin? You know, where does the spiritual element fit into all of this? I mean, really, ultimately, there is no way to sort of completely parse this out. But the fact of the matter is that it's kind of a package deal for most people. Yes, there are always going to be exceptional individuals who are the true cosmopolitans, and they really feel most at home in a city anywhere around the world, you know. And I mean, they like that's some people, and some people can do that, and they're these sort of roving artist and thinker types, and that's for some people. But most people, when they have that situation foisted on them without asking for it, it can be quite
It's unpleasant. It's one thing to have that place, the cosmopolitan place, but if you don't also have a place where it's just your people, then that's another matter. That's suddenly you've got disarray, even for the cosmopolitans who like the incredible range of restaurants. It's still, at the back of their mind, they know that they can go to an English village and it's just the village pub and a pub lunch. You know, they know that that exists. And I think if that didn't exist, then it would be a very different matter. Of course, the current trends, eventually it won't exist. They won't have the home base to return to, because every town and village and city will have been diversified and global homo gayplexified. And so the novelty will be not much of a reassurance, not much of a home. I just want to quote someone from the chat who said, it's not relevant to what we're saying.
No, please go ahead.
It said, "I love the contrast between Woe's Gentile stoic manner and Bab's Levantine energy."
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm doing the like East Mediterranean thing. I'm sorry. I just revert to that state whenever I get worked up in a conversation, because this is something I care about. And on this end, to go back to something that I was talking about earlier that you mentioned, I was talking about the process, like what goes on in the minds of a lot of Jews, where they run these historical events by their heads whenever they feel kind of, something Western, European, Christian is manifesting itself, something Roman, you know, as it were, is manifesting itself. And there's a reasonable fear there, based on, that kind of historical narrative, once one is, embedded in it throughout their entire life. And that sort of makes up their grounding metaphysic. But it's like, what happens after that is the bad part, really, is what the thought process after that is, okay, so European identity will lead to an environment that is ultimately less beneficial to minority groups, even like, more European like minority groups like Jews, who are of mixed European and Middle Eastern descent, or sometimes of full Middle Eastern descent or other things mixed in. But it's like, even Jews, they know diversity is good because, diversity is good. Multiculturalism is good because it's like the souk, no one's going to just go up to someone like in the open air market, go up to them and, stab them like, hey, you're a different race from me, because it's like all the people there are, traders from all the different regions. So it's like, that's a more healthy environment. So it's, there's this natural draw to that kind of situation. But, when it's a country like, let's say it's, 99%, European, 99% Polish, Poland's 99% Polish. And then like, maybe there are like a few Baltic people, and then like a few like Jews and like gypsies, and those Jews and gypsies as like non-European peoples, especially with like that history, will like stand out, and they will like, so it's like, what are we going to do about this? And the problem with a lot of Jews living in the West, especially considering the immense amounts of soft power that we possess right now, especially through things like the European Union and the American government, and like lobbying organizations, sort of stuff like that, and just sort of the media in general, basically, like the kind of media bureaucratic, that whole system, the cathedral is synagogic in many ways, although many of the Jews involved are themselves not religious practitioners of Judaism. But the problem is, the next part is after European identity leads to Jews being treated less well, the thought process isn't, so maybe we can have our own country and have our own thing where we don't need to be worried about perpetually living under the yoke, subject to whatever whims the majority group has has, you know, desires to foist upon us. We can have our own thing. We can have our own nation. No, that's not the instinct that that many Jews have. Unfortunately, the instinct that many Jews have is to shut it down. Shut it down. Shut it down. In the most, and what the worst part is, these Jews will come out and they will go like, you know, as a Jew, I condemn this. As a Jew, we're shutting this down. As a Jew, and it'll be like something completely innocuous. It'll be like someone puts up an "It's okay to be white" poster, and then all these Jewish organizations will come down and be like, you know, get this man fired, ruin his life, send him to jail. And it's like nuts. And see, that fundamentally is the wrong instinct, because that is the instinct that will get, you know, that will, the goyim will know, as it were, you know, people of European descent, people, Westerners are going to reawaken, as it were, in this capacity eventually. And it's simply a matter of, you know, when it's going to happen, because, you know, my people, unfortunately, at least my people in diaspora in America, at least the powerful ones, the ones who are speaking for us, are going to go full throttle before this is done. They already have started to. I mean, look, it's nuts. It's nuts. And then there's, and you know, and there's already starting to be pushback against that. And yeah, it's taking, it's a lot of that's, you know, manifesting itself in either online or in individual acts of, like, you know, God forbid, horrible, violent terrorism. But it's like, eventually the sentiment, I think, is going to grow and grow and grow and catch up, because it's like, ultimately, this is a historical cycle that's been going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I think that, you know, both people, but ideally my people, should be proactive and come to the table and do something other than just shut it down and at least have an honest dialogue. But it's,
I
like,
think that, you know, I think that honesty is the key thing here, because without honesty, you can't really get anywhere. At least, well, actually you can, if you're very crafty. And I think that's what a lot of the Ashkenazi Jews that we're talking about are banking on. They just prevent the other side from saying certain truths, and thus they can control the debate completely. But that ultimately is going to backfire, because, as you say, it breeds huge amounts of resentment and paranoia towards the Jews who do that kind of thing. So, whereas I think with a more, well, with more honesty, we could simply get farther and faster and towards a more desirable outcome, a mutually desirable outcome, actually.
Yeah, that's the thing. The mutually desirable outcome, in my eyes, is ultimately, it's sort of this moral repatriationist stance, just like how there was that very, you know, you could say naive, but idealistic vision of, you know, Marcus Garvey and the Black Star Line. And, you know, that was warped itself by, you know, Eurocentric views and European colonialism. Same with the, you know, the sort of Zionist movements and other sort of like modern 21st century, like Israeli type stuff, which is a shame, because I want it to truly be like our own thing. You know, because we're still ultimately at the end of the day kind of subtly like parasiting off Western culture. Like, I want us to truly have something that is like of our own, truly our own. But at the same time, I mean, not but at the same time, but like, yeah, what you're saying is completely true. The agreement that needs to be reached is like, I mean, it's like, and I know that there are going to be people in the chat who are pushing back against me, but how long has we tried the assimilation experiment with Jews in the West? I mean, just be. I mean, I just don't think that this is. To me, this doesn't look like that successful of an experiment, because all the people that I know, where it's like, oh, you know, my grandfather's a Jew, my grandmother's a Jew, like the quarter Jews, and like those people aren't even. It's not even like genetic at that point. Like, those people are. Let's say that person genetically like 80% European, and they're like 20% Middle Eastern genetically or less, or something like that. But it's like the way they'll think is like, they'll have that kind of outsider-ish or kind of like westness averseness, because aversion, because they'll be thinking in their head, you know, oh, Donald Trump, he's kind of like a fascist. He's kind of like Hitler. My grandparents' family, you know, something about Hitler and et cetera, et cetera. And you see how the thought process goes. So ultimately, I don't think that the, you know, the mixing in and the assimilation experiment has worked that well, albeit, you know, there are instances where it has, you just simply don't hear about it. But I just also, just from my own people's personal perspective, I'm a self-interested Jew. I would like to see all my people working for themselves in their own autonomous polity in our indigenous land, because I think it's in our own best interest. And I think that although, you know, many Westerners might miss us at first, I think you'll soon come to realize that things will be just fine without us, if not better.
Okay. Sorry. Apparently, the last time I spoke, I was rubbing my hands together, and people were saying in the live chat that certain behavioral patterns were already rubbing off on me, even through the Google Hangouts network. I'm sure that was just a coincidence. No pun intended. All right. So, Babs, it's been really nice to have you on the channel again. And I think this has been a nice, punchy, effective, brief hangout. So shall we end it there? Or do you have any last things you'd like to say?
I think I'll hit us with the last quote. Okay, so I just want to clarify to the audience right now, I come from a very secular background with atheistic parents. Right now, I'm increasingly studying more and more Judaism, basically, day by day. I'm like listening to lectures, I'm working on that stuff right now. So I'm kind of exploring that, you know, my ancestral traditional religion. I'm finding a lot of things that I do like and I am drawn to, finding a lot of things that I don't like and that I have some, you know, grievances with, but it's an interesting process. So I'm just letting people know that I'm kind of from a secular background, just because a lot of people, they don't necessarily know what to expect. But let's see. I just want to quickly read a quote from A.D. Gordon. A.D. Gordon writes, "The Jewish people have been completely cut off from nature and imprisoned within city walls for 2,000 years. We have been accustomed to every form of life except a life of labor. Of labor done at our behalf and for its own sake. It will require the greatest effort of will for such a people to become normal again. We lack the principal ingredient for national life. We lack the habit of labor, for it is labor which binds a people to its soil and to its national culture, which is in turn an outgrowth of the people's toil and the people's labor. We, the Jews, were the first in history to say, 'For all the nations shall each go in the name of God, and nations shall not lift up sword against nation.' And then we proceeded to cease being a nation ourselves." All right. Thank you so much for having me on. Babylonian Hebrew, you can find me on, I wrote an article that's the next place where I recommend people go, called The Rot of Diaspora, and that's on West Coast Reactionaries. And this is an old piece. It's not a very well-written article, but I also have a YouTube channel called Babylonian Hebrew. I also have a YouTube channel called The Blue Lizard. I also have a YouTube channel called The Babs Cast. And I think that's about it for YouTube channels. or the other one's called Babylonian Backup. And then I've got a Twitter at Babylonian Hebe. Thank you so much for having me on, Mr. Woz. Pleasure as usual.
Excellent. I did enjoy this. It was very, a novelty. And it was easy to interact. It was fun. All right. So we'll leave it there. And Babylonian Hebrew, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2018.
My pleasure.
All right. Okay. And I will be back very shortly with Erkenbrand. I will see you then. Bye-bye for now.